This presentation has been prepared by Seyfarth Shaw, LLP, for informational purposes only, and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed in this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or a legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general informational purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. At this time, I'd like to turn today's program over to Jessica Mendelson, Associate at Seyfarth Shaw. Jessica, you may begin.
Great. Thanks, Jason. So I'll be speaking today about social media in the workplace. Social media is becoming increasingly prevalent in the modern world. The number of users and the amount of content available is increasing rapidly. Of the big social networks, Facebook currently has over 1 billion users, and more than half of these users use Facebook on a mobile device. Similarly, LinkedIn has 161 million users, and more than 2 new members every second, half of whom are in the United States. One of the other large social networks, Google Plus, has more than 400 million users. And YouTube, another big site, has hundreds of millions of users, including over 800 million unique visits a month. Twitter, one of the biggest social media sites out there, has more than 517 million users, including over 140 million users in the United States. And these users make over 340 million tweets a day. In the business world, the use of social media for business purposes has increased exponentially in the past couple of years. Social media is increasingly being used for marketing purposes. In a worldwide survey, more than 75% of respondents use social media for business purposes, but less than two-thirds of these businesses actually monitored employees' use of social media. So this increasing use begs the question, why worry about social media? Well, we need to worry about social media because it makes it easier for people to disclose valuable trade secrets with a touch of a button. Social media makes it easy to infringe intellectual property rights and makes it easy to disclose valuable trade secrets through the use of social media. This is worrisome for employers because the frequency with which social media is used, and also because it's not always clear who will have access to things posted on social media and who has the right to use this information. So how does this tie into trade secrets? Well, as I mentioned, it's an issue because of what's being shared publicly. I'm going to go through briefly what a trade secret is. A trade secret is information, including formulas, patterns, compilations, devices, methods, or designs, which derive independent economic value from not being generally known or reasonably ascertainable. This information is the subject of reasonable efforts to maintain secrecy. In determining whether something constitutes a trade secret, the courts generally look at 6 different factors. First, the extent to which the information is known outside of the company. Second, the extent to which the information is known by employees and others inside the company. Third, the measures taken by the company to protect the secrecy of the information. Fourth, the value of the trade secret to the company and its competitors. And fifth, the time, effort, and money expended in development. Finally, a court also considers the ease or difficulty with which the information can be acquired or duplicated by others. So there are a number of different acts in the United States that protect against the misappropriation of trade secrets. 2 of them are federal, the Economic Espionage Act and the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which we won't be discussing much today, And the final one is the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. The Uniform Trade Secrets Act is largely codified common law, and it's been enacted in 47 states in the United States. The only states that don't use it are Massachusetts, New York, and Texas. The Act prevents the illegal or unauthorized acquisition, disclosure, or use of information. However, it does not protect against accidental disclosure or reverse engineering. Additionally, under the terms of the Act, third parties are liable if they knew or had reason to know of the misappropriation. So based on this, you might be wondering who is actually stealing these trade secrets. Well, surprisingly, the most common misappropriator are rogue employees and business partners. Statistics suggest that more than 90% of trade secret misappropriation is done by employees, former employees, and business partners. The vast majority of this misappropriation is achieved by electronic means. Employees and business partners have an easy time misappropriating because they have access to and familiarity with the computer systems and the information being stored by the company. In addition, technology makes it really easy to misappropriate. There are a number of tools out there for exfiltration of data, and technology nowadays also allows for remote and cloud computing, which makes it easy to misappropriate from home. So how can employers protect against misappropriation? Well, one way to do it is to have a coherent company policy in place regarding intellectual property, so what can be taken and what is owned by the company. Additionally, employers should take reasonable steps to ensure confidentiality and secrecy of information. They should also ensure that employees are aware of their responsibilities to safeguard confidential information, and be careful that their new employees are not bringing confidential information from their former employers when they start a new job. Additionally, employees should sign non-disclosure agreements with specific language regarding what can and cannot be disclosed. Companies should also consider implementing data theft prevention policies in order to ensure that intellectual property is not being used inappropriately. In addition to protecting against misappropriation, one of the big issues for employers is ensuring compliance with the National Labor Relations Board's guidelines. The National Labor Relations Board has put company social media policies under increased scrutiny. Gary Glazer is going to talk to you a little more about this, but just to briefly introduce it, the NLRB has recently issued three reports which describe the types of social media cases being reviewed by the NLRB. These reports reviewed 20 separate company policies, and of these, 16 were actually found to be overly broad. Several of these decisions actually addressed employee use of Facebook and Twitter accounts, and found that employees were engaged in protected concerted activity in their use of these social media networks. In one of the most recent memoranda, which came out May 30th, 2012, the NLRB stressed the importance of careful drafting in order to avoid broad language that employees could reasonably construe to prohibit protected concerted activities. Additionally, the NLRB made the point that employers' social media policies must specifically define the term confidential information. I'm now going to turn it over to Gary Glazer, who will tell you a little more about the NLRB and also some of the social media case law out there.
Thank you, Jessica. This is a subject that is near and dear to my heart as a former board attorney with the Boston Regional Office of the National Labor Relations Board. This title slide saying labor management relations and trade secrets almost total strangers is unfortunately a bad omen of things to come. Let's look at 2012 and what the National Labor Relations Board did in this area, and in addition, why it was involved at all. Many employers have the misconception that the National Labor Relations Board is only relevant to unionized employers whose employees are represented by unions. In fact, when it was originally passed, that was clearly the primary function of the National Labor Relations Board. However, in addition to covering collective bargaining and designation of collective bargaining representatives, meaning unions, the National Labor Relations Act also provides a Bill of Rights, if you will, to employees, which is called protected concerted activity. Traditional notions of protected and concerted activity, if you look at the phrase itself, involve two main characters. One is the conduct has to be protected. Well, what does it mean to be protected under the National Labor Relations Act? It means that employees must be dealing with each other for the purposes of wages, hours, or other terms and conditions of work. If employees get together and decide they want to unseat a supervisor or manager who is abusive, that likely would not be included in the definition of protected categories under the National Labor Relations Act. So the first thing is you look and see whether or not the individuals are involved in activities covered by the concept of protected activities, wages, hours, or other terms and conditions of employment. The next thing is that it has to be concerted. An individual purportedly acting on his or her own, engaging in activity to increase his or her wages, to have a better working environment, increase the air conditioning during a hot summer day or the like, would not traditionally have been involved in protected concerted activity to have the cloak of protection of the National Labor Relations Act. However, with the advent of social media and the advent of a very aggressive and fairly left-leaning NLRB in recent years, the definition of protected concerted activity has evolved from the original concept of two or more individuals marching into their boss's office and demanding a wage increase for all employees in the job classification, which would clearly be the traditional concept of protected concerted activity, to a single individual asserting rights under a collective bargaining agreement, which would also be deemed to be implicitly collective action, even though it's only one individual, since the collective bargaining agreement covers all the individuals in the bargaining unit, or to an individual who, acting alone, brings group complaints to the attention of management in order to initiate or induce group action. So an individual walks into his or her boss's office and says, we've been talking out there, and we've decided that if we don't get a wage increase consistent with the cost of living increase in the last couple of years, we're just all going to walk out on our jobs. Well, if an employer fired that individual and found out who else was in conspiracy with that individual, they would be engaging in an unfair labor practice under the National Labor Relations Act, even though the individuals are not represented by a union. Ultimately, the NLRB even expanded the concept of protected concerted activity by the current board to areas where an individual is, quote, stirring things up. In a case called Sabo Inc., issued in December of 2012, the board found that an individual was engaged in protected concerted activity when, during a conversation with another employee, she falsely implied that the other employee might be fired. Nothing else was done of any kind of concerted activity, but the NLRB, as it was presently configured, determined that any discussion regarding employment security is inherently concerted. From this, we have to look at the three acting general counsel memos that were issued on social media that Jessica alluded to. And basically, of seven cases, and these were at the pre-complaint stage that the acting general counsel of the NLRB addressed in his memos, six were found to have been overbroad and violating employees' rights to engage in protected concerted activity, while only one was found to have complied with the strictures of the National Labor Relations Act. And social media has now come to the forefront through these various memos and through the board's decision. In one of the first cases addressing Facebook postings and whether or not it constitutes engaging in protective concerted activity, the board, in the case of Hispanics United of Buffalo, Inc., found that a posting on one's Facebook page complaining about his coworkers' failure to pull their own weight in connection with them performing their own duties and responsibilities, which was then responded to by a host of other employees who were objecting to the classification that they were, I guess, slouching out on the job. And then the employer terminated the employees who protested on the employee's Facebook page. That discharge was determined by the NLRB to constitute an unfair labor practice, a wrongful termination for the employees engaging in protected concerted activity. Interestingly, when the shoe is on the other foot, it's not necessarily equality before the law at the NLRB. And then the other side of the coin, there was a strike involved in a case called Amalgamated Transit Union Local 1433, where the union had a Facebook page, and the employees represented by that union were on strike at the employer, and several employees who were members of the union who were striking posted threats on the union's Facebook page directed at individual employees who were crossing the picket line and working despite the strike. The employees who were working filed an unfair labor practice against the union, saying the union's Facebook page was an extension of the union and it was responsible for these threats, which could also be a violation of the National Labor Relations Act. But the board said no, that the Facebook page of the union predated the strike, that there was no evidence that the union was aware of or took efforts to become aware of these postings, and therefore it was not liable for the threats made on its webpage. So what does all this have to do with confidentiality and trade secrets? Well, the NLRB's further inroads into employers' attempts to maintain a civil workplace and to comply with fair employment practice laws also implicates employers' activities to protect their trade secrets. And by the way, the reason why the NLRB is going into this area is because unionization in the private sector is at an all-time low. And the NLRB was concerned, understandably, that if it did not venture into more activity and more aggressive scrutiny of employers in the non-union environment, it was going to become outdated, outmoded, and Congress was going to stop approving labor NLRB budgets and the like. So there is a very good reason from a practical and political standpoint why the NLRB is getting into this area. In the Acting General Counsel's May 30th, 2012 memo, a roadmap of fairly decent detail is provided to employers as to what types of employment policies that deal with the sharing of confidential information may be viewed by the NLRB as either lawful or unlawfully overbroad and interfering with employees' rights to engage in protected concerted activity. In its memo, in one of the cases, the Acting General Counsel found that the employee handbook provision there involved that said, quote, don't release confidential guest, team member, or company information, end quote, is unlawful. In another situation, the Acting General Counsel found that a provision instructing employees not to share confidential information with coworkers unless they need the information to do their job and not to have discussions regarding confidential information in the break room, at home, or in open areas and public places were overbroad and thus unlawful. One of the things that the NLRB, Acting General Counsel, found deficient in these policies is that there was not a clear line drawn between truly proprietary or trade secret type of information and what's considered confidential information about the employees, the workforce, payroll information, workers' wages, hours, schedules, and the like. And that is one of the areas that have been considered traditionally to be at the heart of employees' right to engage in protected concerted activity. Similarly, a provision threatening employees with discharge or criminal prosecution for failing to report unauthorized access to or misuse of confidential information was found to be unlawful. Again, because the Acting General Counsel found that the employer did not in that policy sufficiently define what is true trade secret protectable information versus what is information that we call confidential about employees' wages, hours, and working conditions that an employer cannot prohibit employees from talking about. In another case, in the memo, a portion of a work rule was held to be unlawful to the extent that it instructed employees not to, quote, reveal non-public company information on any public site, and that explained that non-public information encompasses, quote, any topic related to the financial performance of the company, quote, information that has not already been disclosed by authorized persons in a public forum, end quote, personal information about another employee, end quote. It is this last category that was found to be the most problematic by the acting general counsel. And it, because it was in the same breath as talking about information about the company's financial performance that was non-public, the acting general counsel found that the policy was unlawfully overbroad. It should be stressed, however, that financial performance of a company, if it is publicly available, is deemed by the NLRB to be related to employees' wages, hours, and terms and conditions of employment, because how else is an employer, an employee, going to argue that a failure to give wage increase is not justified by the business conditions if an employee can't refer to the employer's public information about the company's financial performance? So says the National Labor Relations Board. Now, these were all the acting general counsel is the prosecutorial arm of the National Labor Relations Board. There is also the NLRB itself, which adjudicates claims where the general counsel has authorized complaints. And several of the recent cases in 2012 addressed issues involving confidentiality or social media or both of them together. A particularly troublesome case by the name of Banner Health System dealt with the confidentiality of internal investigation. And in that case, the NLRB has ruled that an employer's broad ban on employees discussing internal investigations into, for example, sexual harassment or employee relations issues is a violation of their right to engage in protected concerted activity. So the question one may reasonably ask as an employer is, can this board approach coexist with the EEOC's emphasis, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission's and state discrimination agencies' emphasis on the importance of maintaining confidentiality by an employer as part of any non-harassment policy and internal investigations into them? Well, not surprisingly, but partially surprisingly, the EEOC's policy, according to the EEOC, the board's policy is not, or approach, is not inconsistent with that of the EEOC. Although confidentiality is important, it is equally important, the EEOC and the NLRB say, to ensure that employees have access to information that they may need in order to press complaints or grievances about what's going on in the workplace. The important thing to keep in mind when one is implementing a rule dealing with workplace investigation confidentiality, according to the board, is an employer must tailor the policy as narrowly as possible to address specific concerns related to each individual investigation, such as the potential for employees to get together so they can fabricate testimony or to avoid the destruction of potentially helpful documentation and evidence. In September of 2012, the first decision issued by the NLRB focusing on the issues covered by the acting general counsel in his May 30th, 2012 memo, that is, employers' social media policies and their impact on employees' right to engage in protected concerted activity. In that case, the board held that a company policy providing, among other things, that, quote, sensitive information such as membership, payroll, confidential financial, and other such similar information may not be shared, transmitted, or stored for personal or public use without prior management approval. The board held that that policy was unlawfully overbroad, particularly where the rule also stated that employees are responsible for ensuring that all information relating to the company and its employees, the latter point being particularly relevant in this context, is secure and not to be disseminated. The board's position in that case was that employees could unfortunately be led to believe that by saying information about coworkers was to be kept confidential and not to be disseminated or discussed would have a chilling effect on their engaging in protected concerted activity. Well, a logical question that may be asked for those of you who read the newspapers and are aware that the National Labor Relations Board's very existence currently has been challenged by the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals that ruled that President Obama's recess appointments to the NLRB were unconstitutional because they did not occur during the recess between congressional sessions, which only happened once or twice a year, but instead were intersession, intra, rather, session recesses where they occurred during a particular session of Congress or a very brief recess for other purposes. This case, President Obama's administration has indicated that it is going to, by the way, as a result, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that in that case, called Noel Canning v. NLRB, that the decision of the NLRB, where three members of the board were recess appointments and therefore unconstitutional, could not be enforced by the court. The Obama administration recently indicated that they are taking that case to the Supreme Court, hopefully in their mind to be reversed. In the meantime, we've got to wait and see what the Supreme Court does. There is a history of courts ruling in favor of recess appointments, but this particular issue applying to an agency such as the NLRB has not been ruled on before. So we have trade secrets, restrictive covenants, and social media. The next question that we're going to address outside the context of the NLRB is who owns what and what is a poor employer to do? There are several cases that we're going to touch base on which pertain to courts addressing the question of whether or not one's Facebook postings, whether one's followers in a Twitter account and the like are protectable as trade secrets. Also, whether or not postings on Facebook page, for example, can constitute solicitation in violation of a no solicitation clause that an individual may be bound to. The first case that I'm going to talk about is the case of Eagle v. Morgan coming out of the Eastern District of Pennsylvania Federal Court. In that case, the company promoted itself using an employee's LinkedIn account. After the employee left, the company seized the account and transferred it to another employee. The employee, through LinkedIn and the agreement between LinkedIn and the employee, because as many of you know, individual users of LinkedIn are bound by agreements with LinkedIn. In this case, the company did not have its own LinkedIn account. It was the individual's account. The employee was able to regain control of the account, and both sides sued each other, making lots of good work for lawyers. The court first determined that the LinkedIn account was not a trade secret in that case because it determined that the information in question was, quote, generally known in the wider business community, end quote, or that it could be easily derived from public information and sources. And in fact, the former employee pointed out that a lot of the, quote, confidential information that the employer was complaining that the employee, former employee, was using was disclosed by the employer itself on its website, such as its principal client. So a word to the wise, be careful what you post on your company websites, lest you try to claim that it's not subject to disclosure or use by a former employee, but the employee can turn around and say, but it's posted to the general public. In addition, in this case, the court also found that the employer did not take reasonable steps to maintain its secrecy, which, as Jessica pointed out, is a critical factor when it comes to determination of trade secret status. The court did determine, however, that issues of fact existed as to whether the employee's use of account of the LinkedIn account supported a common law claim for misappropriation, which was a cross-claim, counterclaim brought by the employer. In Pennsylvania, there's a recognition of a claim for misappropriation of an idea. And so the court refused to dismiss that in a motion to dismiss stage. But then recently, there was a decision after the bench trial, the court said that misappropriation of an idea claim did not stand because, and these are several words to the wise to keep in mind, because the employer never had a policy requiring employees to use LinkedIn as a marketing tool. Number two, that the employer did not dictate the precise contents of an employee's LinkedIn account. And three, that the employer did not pay for the employee's LinkedIn account. Indeed, the court pointed out the fact that the employer didn't even maintain its own separate LinkedIn account, and the employer presented no evidence that the plaintiff's contact list was developed and built through the investment of the employer's time or money as opposed to the employee's own time and expense, plus the individual's extensive past experience in the same industry. So some very good words to the wise come out of this case, which just recently issued its decision about a week ago. After bench trial, in addition to that ruling, the judge concluded that the plaintiff, the former employee, owned her LinkedIn profile, not the company. The plaintiff won her claims for unauthorized use of her name, invasion of privacy by misappropriation, and misappropriation of publicity, all common law claims available under the Eastern in Pennsylvania. However, it was a Pyrrhic victory for the plaintiff because, she represented herself, and when she went to prove damages, she provided no evidence that any of the damages that she provided evidence to in any way were connected to any unlawful conduct, alleged unlawful conduct, of the employer. As a result, the court found that although she had valid claims for all these bases, that the evidence of damages was too speculative. The judge also rejected plaintiff's claims for identity theft under Pennsylvania law because it found no unlawful purpose in the employer's conduct and also a lack of identifying information as defined by that common law claim in Pennsylvania. Dismissed the plaintiff's claim for conversion because that applies in Pennsylvania only to tangible property, not to the cyberspace property involved here. And tortious interference, since no actual legal damage could be proven by plaintiff. Civil conspiracy on multiple grounds, and also dismissed a civil aiding and abetting claim because, again, the plaintiff, who appeared pro se, as I indicated, presented no evidence as to the actions by the individual defendant, only by the company. Now turn to a case out of the Northern District of California by the name of Phone Dog v. Kravitz. Phone Dog is an interactive mobile news and website review website, and the former employee was a product reviewer and video blogger employed by Phone Dog. While employed, the employee helped manage the company's Twitter account, which was at @PhoneDog_Noah. The individual's employee was Noah Kravitz. The employee left, seized the Twitter account, and changed the account handle to, quote, @NoahKravitz, end quote. The company sued. The court denied the employee's motion to dismiss, finding that the employee's theft of the Twitter account stated the claim for misappropriation of trade secrets. So what happened? Well, the parties settled. And in the connection with the parties' settlement negotiations, the defendant, the former employee, basically said, it would have been a lot better if the company had an agreement with me that defined and identified who owned what and whose information it was. Word to the wise once again. If you have employees using Twitter accounts to help develop business on behalf of the company, make sure that you develop a social media policy, internet usage policy, which expressly provides that the account is the ownership of the company and that any information that is cultivated as a result of that belongs to the company. Another case, the case of Christo v. Beauport, which is out of Massachusetts, out of Colorado, the state of Colorado. In Christo v. Beauport, the employer was the owner of nightclubs, and a former partner was the defendant who developed electronic dance music download website. And what was at issue there was whether or not the MySpace login information and the friends list that the employee allegedly misappropriated from the former employer were trade secrets, which were subject to protection under Colorado law. The court found the court denied defendants' motion to dismiss and found that the MySpace friend relationship could be a trade secret, so that the trade secret claim survived at least at the motion to dismiss stage. However, the court stressed that what is protectable isn't the list of friends, which is public, but the friend relationship itself, because it lets you view your friends' contact information, interests, and preferences. The litigation in that case is ongoing. Another case out of Massachusetts Superior Court was a non-compete case, not a trade secrets case. In that case, the employee signed a non-solicitation agreement. During her employment, she became Facebook friends with at least 8 clients of the former employer, who was a hairstylist salon. She took those 8 clients with her, to the extent that when she joined a competitor, she posted on her Facebook page that she had a new job, and the former employer sued the hair salon, claiming that the employee solicited customers by staying friends with them on her Facebook page after she left and through posting about her new job on her Facebook page. The court denied the former employer's motion for a preliminary injunction, holding that staying Facebook friends with customers was not, quote, solicitation, end quote. Massachusetts takes a narrow view of solicitation. There has to be active initiation of contact by the employee. It's not just enough to post something on your Facebook page. And posting that she even had a new job on their Facebook page also was determined not to be solicitation. Final case is Sasqua Group v. Courtney, Eastern District of New York. Here, the court was dealing with a recruiting firm that maintained a database that included client contact information, profiles, hiring preferences, and descriptions of previous interactions. When the employee left to start a competing company, the recruiting firm sued, alleging she had misappropriated trade secrets from the database. Adopting the magistrate judge's report and recommendation, the court held that the database should not be afforded trade secret protection and denied the plaintiff's motion for an injunction. The significant facts in the Sasqua case are that the defendant, Ms. Courtney, was able to take the stand and testified that the virtually all of the information in this financial services industry executive search firm's database was available on the web, and she was able to recreate through her testimony verbally by going through a verbal demonstration describing what steps she would take to recreate virtually all of the information contained in the Sasqua database by using the internet and the vast amount of information available to it on it, and that she would start with LinkedIn because she stated people in the financial services industry put their whole profile on LinkedIn. Indeed, ultimately, court ultimately concluded that the information publicly available exceeded the amount and level of detail contained in the Sasqua database and was not protectable as a trade secret. The parties settled shortly after the court also found that the information in the database was exceedingly old and stale, and that the employer had failed to take even basic steps to protect the secrecy of the information, and there was no agreement between the individual and the company as to the ownership of the LinkedIn account. Words to the wise again. And with that, I'm going to turn the floor over to my fellow partner out of our Chicago office, Scott Schaefer.
Thank you, Gary. Greetings, everybody, from Chicago. It's about 21 degrees here today, right or wrong, the day before spring. The moment you've all been waiting for, I'm about to give you the CLE code. Hopefully many of you, if not all of you, will stay on after, but hey. So, to receive CLE credit for this webinar, please write down the following code on the CLE attendance affirmation form, which will be emailed to you by the end of this week. The code is SS5219. Again, that's S as in Seifarth, S as in Shaw, 5219. Okay, for the third and final part of our presentation today, I'll be talking about the recent legislation banning mandatory account info turnover by employees, whether that's a good or a bad thing or somewhere in between. Before we move on to the next slide, I'll tell you a little bit about the presentation. I'll first tell you about the states that have such legislation in effect, signed by the governors, what those laws say, what they don't say, what they're aimed at protecting, what are some of the unintended consequences we might see from such legislation, or perhaps intended, and whether this trend of legislation in favor of employee privacy is at all at odds with the administration's recent efforts to promote employer trade secret security. So with that, I'll dive right in. First slide, this is the state of the union, so to speak, of employee social networking privacy legislation. The states listed, we're all set. Again, the states listed, those are the states with current legislation in effect signed by the governor. does the federal government have such legislation? Uncle Sam, and the answer is no, it does not. Twice the bill has been introduced, the first time in early 2012, it died in committee. The second time was within the last several weeks, same congressman, Congressman Engel out of New York, introduced the same bill, Social Networking Online Protection Act, but it is unlikely to go anywhere out of committee as well. So this is, in general, this is what the laws say. I don't want to fly spec each and every piece of legislation. They all vary in some of the certain content and exemptions, but generally speaking, this is what they say. Employers, whether public, some both public and private, are prohibited from requiring and in many instances even asking employees to provide their passwords or related information for their social networking profiles. So what does social networking mean? Generally, the statutes are very broad in that respect. It's a finite online profile in which people can construct lists of friends and say things about themselves. Obviously, it's the Facebooks, the MySpaces, the LinkedIns, Twitters, so on and so forth. Some pending legislation, for example, in New Jersey, the bill currently would outlaw employers asking an employee not just for their password, but whether the employee has a social networking account. So a lot of these statutes are fairly broadly worded. Not all of them, though, as we'll see in a moment. As far as the enforcement of these statutes, they make it unlawful. The statutes make it unlawful for the employers to take action against employees for not only rightfully refusing to provide the passwords or the quote related account information, but also for reporting a violation, aka whistleblowing, or participating in a violation investigation, for example, testifying, giving an interview, so on and so forth. And with many of these statutes, the damages can be, I won't say steep in, as it relates to, say, a $1 billion judgment, but they could be seen as disproportionate to the offense, right? There's actual damages, a penalty kicker under some statutes, say $2,500 for each offense, and there is a plaintiff's prevailing party fee shift provision in many of these statutes. So that's essentially what these laws say. Now, what's the idea? What is the purpose behind these laws? Okay. As Jessica mentioned at the very beginning of her presentation, social networking is all the rage these days. That's how people communicate, younger people in any event, right? 1 billion Facebook users, hundreds of millions of Twitter tweets every day. And so that's how people interact with one another. So not unlike an employer who, generally speaking, should not, if not prohibited, from asking somebody at a job interview or a current employee, what nationality are you? What religion are you? What's your personal life like? Are you married? You know, all those protected classes that we see in the employment context, it's the same idea. If you require turnover of social networking information, then you're going to be able to take a peek into the employee's personal life, and in many times an employer might make an adverse employment action or take an adverse employment action based on information in the networking profile that could be out of context. For example, an ex-friend of an employee posts something on the employee's LinkedIn profile, Facebook profile, that's not very nice to the employee. Well, is the employer going to act unfairly and out of context on that piece of information? Perhaps. And so those are some of the ideas that are behind the policies that are behind some of this legislation. So we've talked so far about what's covered by the legislation. Now let's talk about what some of the exceptions and exemptions might be, right? Some of the statutes exempt employer monitoring of their own computers, PDAs, desktops, so on and so forth, just to ensure that employees are using company property properly. Right? Other statutes do not prohibit employers from requiring password turnover for, quote, non-personal accounts. Now, believe it or not, those three question marks in parentheses were intentionally put there for this presentation. It wasn't an editing mistake on my part. One of the things that came to mind when I was reading this legislation is, well, what the heck does personal versus non-personal mean? And many people use their LinkedIn profiles, Facebook, Twitter, for both reasons, to promote themselves and credential themselves for work, and also to catch up with their friends, their buddies, talk about the NCAA tournament coming on, what have you, right? And so there's some gray area there about what's personal and non-personal. Some other exceptions are, and you'll see this in the Illinois statute, you'll see this in the, forgive me, the state legislation escapes me right now, but when an employer has a good faith belief that there's been a violation of the law, for example, a violation of securities law, or if an employee has misused proprietary information / trade secrets, then the employer, upon that good faith belief, can ask for a mandatory turnover of information under some of the statutes. And, well, lastly, some of the statutes exempt or specifically carve out an employer's search for information that is otherwise in the public domain. So, for example, an employee has a very private Facebook profile, right? So long as the employer doesn't ask for the password and obtains information about that employee, which may not, believe it or not, be in the private part of the profile, then the statute would carve out that conduct. The employer has done nothing wrong. So those are some of the exceptions and exemptions that we've seen recently. Okay, so we've seen that the six states have legislation. There's about 25, 26 other states that are thinking about it, which means that bills have been introduced and have been referred to committee in various of the states. In various states, some states, like Washington, up until a few days ago at least, had a very broad social networking bill. It said that asking for whether the employee has a social networking account, and if so, or relatedly, what's the password, that's unlawful, and there were not many exceptions. Now, the Senate recently amended it as of March 13th, I believe, when I looked it up last. As of March 13th, the Washington Senate had amended the bill to make it narrower. But as many of the bills start out, they start out broad and then they get narrowed and refined as they go through the committee process and perhaps to the other chamber in the state legislature. All right. So the point of my part of the presentation was, is it good or bad? Well, here are some of the things that we'd rather not see happen, but which could happen based on the breadth of the legislation and some of the broad available remedies under legislation. First, baseless lawsuits, and in parentheses, those fee shift provisions where a prevailing plaintiff gets an award of attorney's fees, those usually whet the appetite of aggressive plaintiff's lawyers. As anybody who's dealt in any consumer advocacy or employment discrimination context would probably agree with at least some of that. So what would some of the claims be based on? Well, a manager comes by his or her assistant's desk and says, "Hey, you got a Facebook account?" Or the manager comes by, another colleague or perhaps a subordinate and says, "Hey, give me your Facebook account. I'm going to friend you. Let's be friends." Well, hey, under some of the legislation, that might be unlawful. And just the manager with a purely friendly intent would what may have subjected his employer to violation of the act. And second, another example, what I mentioned earlier, what the heck constitutes a personal versus a non-personal networking account? Let's say that the employee had a pre-existing LinkedIn profile, then joined the employer and put and listed that employer under his or her experience. Well, is it personal? Is it non-personal? You know? How much information in there has to be of a personal nature or of a business nature before you can make that decision? So these are tricky legal questions, and tricky legal questions often lead to at least a lot of unwelcome lawsuits, right? Secondly, if employers are prohibited from investigating their employees' activity or monitoring their employees' online activity. Now, mind you, in some states there are exceptions under the statute for good faith monitoring of trade secret misuse, for example, right? Well, how are employers supposed to enforce their rights in trade secrets if they're not, if they're sealed off from one of the perhaps easiest ways for employees to take them and spread them and misuse them, right? So that's one of the things that we'd want to think about. Also, there are only 6 states in the 50-state union that have this legislation, but half the other states are thinking about it. So, you know, here's the patchwork of different legislation. And it's particularly troubling, might be the word, where we have a telecommuting employee who lives in one state, but whose home office is in another state. Perhaps, if you know, so which state's law will govern? Let's say the home state and the employee location state, one has legislation, the other doesn't. Well, which state's law should apply? We'll run into those expensive and very academic the conflict of law analyses, and you know, employer, the parties will spend $25,000 just litigating which law should apply. And so those are some of the problems that we perceive with some of the, that I perceive at least, with some of this employee privacy legislation. And some, well, to continue on, I suppose, as Gary was mentioning and described each of these cases, the Eagle, Phone Dog, Christo, each of those cases at least suggested a measure of employer ownership in the employee's online networking profiles, right? And those were based on common law theories of, well, breach of duty of loyalty. Maybe it's on, maybe it's based on the statutory trade secret a claim brought by the employer. Well, there is a conflict, there's a potential conflict between those decisions and some of the state legislation that we're seeing. If employers cannot enforce their rights in employee profiling, online networking profiling, then how can the employers have at least a measure of ownership in those profiles according to these decisions that Gary described earlier? Right? Another issue, another tricky issue is, as most of us know, employers are often sued for negligent hiring, retention, or supervision of employees who do something wrong, right? And oftentimes, employees might post something on his or her Facebook, MySpace, Twitter profile that would lead a reasonably prudent employer to believe that the employee isn't up to the job or isn't qualified for the job, or is a risk for the particular job. If the employee posts something on his or her Facebook profile, for example, one of the examples I came up with was, let's say an in-house delivery driver posts on his Facebook profile that, oh boy, I got another DUI last night, right? This is a delivery driver, uses a car for a living, in-house employee with the employer, okay? 6 months later, that same employee runs over somebody after having a few drinks. Well, that employer, who did not want to run afoul of this employee online networking legislation, didn't look into, at his Twitter feed, didn't look at his Facebook profile. And so Did the employer negligently retain, negligently supervise, or didn't he? Those are some of the tricky legal questions that we might be presented with. So, as with any well-intentioned legislation, it could lead to unintended consequences, tough legal questions that employers, despite their best efforts, despite their seeking legal counsel, just might not be able to avoid. Next, some of the state legislation might conflict with what the Obama administration has recently been trying to do in order to protect private sector employers' trade secrets. The WWOD title of this slide, that's not political, it's just, you know, it's just what came to mind. The Obama administration has come out with, or has taken, two measures, according to this slide. President Obama also signed a recent executive order along the same lines listed here. One is the multifaceted approach that the administration is taking, as announced on February 20th by the White House. You see points 2 through 5 there. I deliberately omitted point 1, which was aimed at increasing diplomacy efforts with foreign nations in order to step up trade secret protection. That didn't seem relevant here because there's not much that state legislatures can do in the area of foreign policy, right? But as you see from points 2 through 5, the administration, the four prongs, these four prongs of that approach are to reach out to the private sector, provide them training, provide them resources, teach them how to better protect their trade secrets. So that's the policy behind that February 20th announcement from the White House. Okay. Relatedly, somewhere right around the first of the year, give or take a few days, the first of 2013, the White House signed into, or the president signed into law, the amendment to the Economic Espionage Act. And I believe Jessica had previously, though briefly, mentioned it in her presentation. Essentially, the amended act broadens protection for domestic employers' trade secrets. It makes not only market-facing products and market-facing trade secrets protectable, but it also protects internal intellectual property assets, computer codes, for example, that were at issue in the Alenikov case. Alenikov was convicted of an economic espionage violation because he had stolen computer code, allegedly, right? Well, the act wasn't clear on whether the theft of internal computer code was a violation of the EEA, and based on that unclarity, non-clarity, and based on the rule of lenity, the Second Circuit overturned his federal conviction, right? The EEA, the amended EEA, also doubled the fines for violations from $5 million to $10 million, doubled the fines for, doubled the maximum fines, mind you. So all in all, the EEA amendment was yet another step by the administration to further and to strengthen the protections for employer trade secrets. Now, having described those two efforts by the White House, are those at odds with this trend of state legislation, which makes it unlawful for employers to monitor their employees' activities online? As Jessica told you, most misappropriators, or at least the most common form of misappropriation, are by rogue employees who divert trade secrets to competitors. So would the state legislation kind of conflict with Uncle Sam, Uncle Sam's purposes of strengthening employer protections? That's just one thing that will come up, I think, in the discourse as we go further. So just to conclude the presentation, the moral of the story, and these are my observations, of course, is that if state governments are going to enact online networking privacy legislation, then they should do it so employers can still protect their rights. They should exempt employer-owned devices, laptops, cell phones that are issued by the employers, right? They should exempt when the employers have good faith beliefs of employee misconduct or theft of trade secrets. And they should make the attorney's fees shift provisions two-way streets, right? If a Now, if an employer knowingly and willfully violates the act, then they're liable for attorney's fees. On the other hand, if a plaintiff brings a bad faith suit or brings a suit just to harass the employer or as retaliation for a good faith termination against the employer, then they should be made to pay for attorney's fees. That would perhaps check or place a check on some of the frivolous lawsuits that we might see as a result of this legislation. So, I believe that's the conclusion of our presentation. I've seen out of the corner of my eye during my presentation that there were some questions. We can address those offline. Is that right, Nicole? Yes, we can. If you want to contact me offline, I'm happy to talk to you about it. And so, again, we thank you very much for attending our webinar today. And have a good day. Thank you very much.
Thank you again for joining us today. This concludes today's web conference. You may now disconnect.